Over the last couple of days, I've had an opportunity to attend several presentations, and I think we've really seen several interesting communications frameworks and paradigms that are all born from the research. I know the California Immunization Coalition has one. I have one that I'll be presenting at 4 o'clock. And they really all, the replication in and of itself, I think, is important because they're all starting to focus on the fact that we can't really use the traditional framework anymore for communicating with parents about vaccines. If we were to just use a traditional framework, we would be able to say to a vaccine-hesitant parent, look, there are simply no data to support a causal relationship between vaccines and autism, talk about the studies, and then say, vaccines save lives, and of course your child has to be vaccinated. But that doesn't work anymore. So I'm really pleased to see so many new models. The one I'm going to talk about at 4, and I'm just going to tee it up a little bit now, ours is a 4-step program, California's is a 3-step program, RA has 7 steps, but really they all talk about the same thing, the need to acknowledge the parent's concern and really try to start off a conversation where you find something on which you can agree, because this sets a tone for the conversation of willingness to listen and empathy. In our model, we talk about the importance of the practitioner describing what he or she has done specifically to build his or her knowledge base. And you are all at a great advantage because one thing you can say is, I just got back from the National Immunization Conference where we talked about this. The third step is to talk about the science and refer specifically to the vaccine studies and, in this case, the autism studies. And then finally, to give advice to the patient based on science. And we also use the phrase in our model that this is what I do with my own children. In our practice, we love our children. We care about them so much. And so, of course, that's why we want them to be vaccinated. But in all of the paradigms, there's really one thing in common, and that is that there's this step where you need to talk about the science, either the science specifically regarding vaccines or the science about the autism. And since 25% of the parents in the recent pediatric study named autism as a side effect of MMR, I wanted to take some time today and go through a little bit of the science about autism. Just some very basic information so that when you're having that conversation with patients' parents, you'll be able to say, I just got back from this conference and we talked about autism and here are some of the things that I've learned about the science. Because I do agree with Ari that we are never going to be finished with this conversation about do vaccines cause autism until we are able to say what does cause autism. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about autism and what we know about some of the causes of autism. So when we use the word autism, we're actually talking about autism spectrum disorders, which is a group of 5 developmental disabilities that includes classic autism, PDD-NOS, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, Asperger syndrome, Rett syndrome, and childhood disintegrative disorder. And what all 5 have in common is that there are impairments in what we call the 3 core domains. Social functioning, which is really an interest in people, and joint attention, which is the ability to show interest in something that someone else is speaking about. And in young children, we see this through imaginative play, or the failure to engage in imaginative play, where they're using a toy, they'll pick up a block and use it as a telephone, or they will have conversations between 2 dolls. The second core domain is communication. We see delays and disorders in language and speech. And then third is the behavior domain, where children with autism tend to present with repetitive behaviors, tantrums, aggressive behaviors, and really stereotypic behaviors that really interfere with their ability to learn. We see some self-injurious behaviors as well. So what causes autism is really the key word. And unfortunately, right now, the answer is still, we don't know. We certainly know a lot more about autism than we did 10 years ago, but we still don't know with certainty what causes autism. We do know that it's a highly heritable genetic disorder, and we know this based on studies that have been done with twins. So looking at a group of mental disorders, actually autism is probably the most heritable disorder. And the reason we know that it's a genetic disorder is, again, because of these studies with twins, where if we look at identical monozygotic twins, the likelihood that both of those children will be diagnosed with autism, if one is between 60 and 80%, depending on the studies. Whereas if we look at dizygotic twins or non-identical twins, the recurrence rate if one is diagnosed with autism, the likelihood that the other is also diagnosed with autism is around 15%, which is the same rate as any other sibling. So that's a really key fact that you can use to communicate with parents in your practice about how do we know that it's genetic. We know that it's genetic based on these studies of twins. We also know that there are some environmental factors that can lead to autism. We know that during pregnancy, if a mother is diagnosed with rubella, she's more likely to have a child with autism. The same if the mother takes thalidomide during pregnancy. We also know if the mother is taking valproic acid during pregnancy, her child is more likely to be diagnosed with autism. And there's some other really good research that's going on right now looking at other maternal immune responses and increased rates of autism. But what we know is that autism is a syndrome where the developmental trajectory has simply gone off course. And we know this because it's really due to the delays in social interaction, that individuals with autism are not attending to faces in early childhood the way a typically developing baby has that immediate response between mother and child. That simply is going awry in the first few weeks of life. And as a result, our kids are failing to develop an expertise in people. And what we see instead is they begin to develop an expertise in objects. So Ari did a nice job of going through some of the data regarding vaccines and autism. I'm just going to go through it very quickly. The first model of how vaccines might cause autism was related to MMR. She talked a little bit about Andrew Wakefield and his publication in The Lancet, which was retracted in 2010. We also now have 12 studies looking at whether MMR causes autism, and none of them show that there's any causal link between MMR and autism. Secondly, with thimerosal, the thought was, well, maybe it's the thimerosal preservative in vaccines that's causing autism. As Ari said, this was removed from all vaccines except flu in 1999, and we've seen no resulting decrease in the diagnosis or prevalence of autism, which, of course, we would expect if it were thimerosal. And then on top of that, we also have 8 studies specifically looking at thimerosal, one of which actually showed that thimerosal could be protective against autism, but in any event. And so now the goalpost has really shifted to it's too many too soon, kids get too many vaccines, and this is overwhelming their immune system. And again, as Ari said, we really have to focus not on the number of vaccines, but on the number of immunological components contained in vaccines. I think it's very appropriate to talk about how improvements in technology have led to much cleaner vaccines, and that what children are receiving in a vaccine in terms of immunological components is literally a drop in the ocean compared to the biological challenges that they're faced breathing the air on the earth. So with regard to autism diagnosis, children with autism can usually be diagnosed by age 3, and now we can start to diagnose. There are studies that are showing we can diagnose at 18 months, 14 months. A great study is coming out of Yale that's showing we can diagnose at 6 weeks. So once we're able to diagnose at 6 weeks, we'll really be in a much better position to get children into early intervention. There's no medical biological test yet for autism. The diagnosis is still made based on the child's behavior, observing the child's behavior in a clinical setting, and also based on parent reporting and parent questionnaire. But there is a lot of good research now focused on trying to identify a biomarker. We have biomarkers that are looking at head circumference. For example, there's good research now that shows that children with autism have an unusual pattern of head growth and that they show a rapid rate of head growth during their first year of life, and then that trails off. So we're looking at head growth. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if we could diagnose autism simply with a tape measure? That would be terrific. There's a lot of good work going on looking for a biomarker based on how children are looking at different things, whether they're looking at people's eyes or focused on people's mouths. There's biomarker work now looking using fMRI, functional MRI, that's looking at how typical children's brains work when they're speaking or learning language versus the parts of the brains that are used by children who are diagnosed with autism, and whether an fMRI that's taken of very young children can actually be used as a diagnostic biomarker. And then we also are building every day our arsenal of genetic tests and genetic markers. And depending on, again, which study you're looking at, between 3 and 15% of children with autism can now be diagnosed through genetic screen. I also want to reiterate that every child with autism is different. There's something about each of them that is the same, but as Fred Volkmar at Yale likes to say, if you've seen one child with autism, you've seen one child with autism. Since this is a CDC conference, I wanted to give a little plug for the CDC's terrific Learn the Signs, Act Early program. We talk all the time, out there all the time saying, learn the signs, learn the signs. And so whenever I'm speaking, I always like to tell the signs. So some of the key red flags are really a child, if a child is not babbling or cooing or making linguistic sounds by 12 months, that's a sign. If children are not gesturing or pointing by 12 months, and really pointing in an effort to draw your attention to something, you know, not sort of just making the pointing motion, which is what my daughter did. She used to tap on everything, and so when our pediatrician said, does she point? I said, she points all day. A child should respond to his or her name by 12 months. This was one that we heard all the time from parents. My child seemed like he or she was deaf. They should respond to their name by 12 months. They should be saying single words by 16 months. Children should be saying two-word phrases by 24 months, and those are novel utterances, not repeating what you've said or what they've heard on a video or you read or something you've read to them in a book, but novel two-word phrases. And any time a child has any loss of language or any loss of social skills, that's certainly a red flag. The reason it's so important to know the signs and the second part of the CDC's campaign is act early. So it's learn the signs and act early. And the reason we want to act early is because early intervention is probably the best weapon we have right now in the fight against autism. Kids can make meaningful gains in an evidence-based early intervention program. We know that between 30 and 50% of the kids who get intensive early intervention can be mainstreamed by kindergarten. You're going to hear in your practice about a wide range of treatments for autism. Some of them have evidence behind them, and unfortunately some don't. Right now our intervention of choice is applied behavior analysis, also speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, social skills training. These are all evidence-based interventions. We have two pharmacological interventions that are FDA approved. They're for symptoms associated with autism, but not yet for core symptoms. Those are Risperdal and Abilify. And then we have special schools that are using evidence-based approaches. Then there are a wide range of other treatments that parents are using, everything from music therapy to, yes, read down the list, marijuana. And not for the parents. This is data from the Interactive Autism Network, which is a database, a parent-reported database, so keep that in mind when we look at the data. But basically it shows that there are 381 identified treatments for autism that are in use by parents. The average number of simultaneous treatments that children are receiving is about 5, although actually half of the kids you'll see are getting 4 or fewer treatments. About 5% of children with autism get no treatment at all. I also just wanted to point out that there was one child in the study who was receiving 56 simultaneous treatments. When parents come into your office who have children with autism, I think a lot of times you'll find that they are often the most vaccine hesitant. The younger siblings of children with autism are... I don't know how to fix that. Thank you. Because a diagnosis of autism really changes the entire family. Families are emotionally devastated. They feel guilty. They wonder if somehow it's something that they did. There's still a lot of stigma associated with a diagnosis of autism. And there's a lot of anger by our families. So I want to echo what Ari said and really say, please take extra time, because our families do tend to be vaccine hesitant. And I was going to say before that the younger siblings of children with autism are among the most under-vaccinated. But again, autism really has a huge effect on how the family functions. It affects the marriage, it affects the older and the younger siblings, it affects grandparents. A lot of our parents report depression. There's tremendous parental stress tied to the child's behavior. And so a lot of families really adopt this I'm going to try anything attitude because no one can tell me why this happened. And we often do see a lot of disdain for medical professionals simply because the medical profession right now does not have that much to offer. Hopefully, as we do more of these studies trying to build the evidence base for more treatments, that will change. With regard to research itself, there are some good sources, there's some really good sources of where you can turn to get up-to-date, more specific information about research that's coming out. Every year, the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee, which is the intergovernmental committee through HHS, that's comprised of all of the governmental agencies that work in autism. We produce a strategic plan every year. That strategic plan is really organized based on questions that parents ask about autism. When should I be concerned? Why did this happen? How can I prevent autism? What are the treatments for autism? What can I expect from my adolescent as my child becomes an adolescent? What can I expect as my child becomes an adult? Each section has a what we know about autism and what we need to know about that area of autism. And all of that is posted online. And it's really a great place to go for specific information about autism. And then in addition, the IACC every year puts out a summary of autism research advances, where the committee selects 20 papers that really have moved the field forward. And this year, there were some really terrific advances. There's a great study that looked at mothers with rheumatoid arthritis and celiac disease and showed that they were more likely to have a child with an autism spectrum disorder. And this was a nice big study. It was 690,000 families out of Denmark. It was published in Pediatrics. This year, researchers were able to identify 27 genetic variants found in people with autism, but not in typically developing people. A lot of these were called copy number variants. That's a hot buzzword now in autism. Those are microscopic deletions or insertions of DNA. Most of the deletions or insertions really pointed to areas that were around neuronal synapses. So a lot of the research is starting to converge on autism being a disorder of the synapse. And what this will enable us to do once we've identified genes is we can identify the associated proteins, figure out whether there's too much of that protein or too little of that protein, and then move in with targeted interventions and therapeutics. And we are starting to see that happen. There are several studies now looking at mouse models of autism where they create a strain of mice that have the extra copies of the genes or are missing those genes, and they're able to, in some cases, reverse the symptoms by coming in with targeted therapeutics. A lot of this information is going to be presented this May at the International Meeting for Autism Research. That's held every year in May. So at the end of May, you will see, hopefully in the media, a lot more information about what the latest learning is with regard to autism. There's also an important study included here that showed that the incidence of gastrointestinal disorders in children with autism was no different than the incidence of gastrointestinal disorders in typically developing children. That was also published in Pediatrics. So this is a terrific resource. Another terrific resource I like to think is our website, the Autism Science Foundation. We're a new organization. We're 1 year old last Monday. Our main goal is to raise money to fund great research to answer the question of what does cause autism. We also support families specifically by reinforcing the message that there's no science that indicates a causal link between autism and vaccines, and that we should not be withholding life-saving vaccines from children with autism or from their siblings. And we were founded by parents and scientists working together. I always like to stress that this is not a question over which scientists and parents disagree. The media loves to portray it that way. They love to show the scientists say this, but the moms say this. they have to work really hard to find that mom. And I know that because they'll call me and they'll say, can you put me in touch with a mom who has a child with autism who doesn't want to vaccinate the younger sibling? And I'll say, if you're having a hard time finding that person, maybe you should think about why that is. But I like to call that casting. Again, please refer to our website. We have great information not only about vaccines and autism, but also about autism research in general. And having been to Amy and Dawn and all those presentations yesterday about social media, I added our social media sites. We have a great blog on WordPress. We're on Facebook. Please become our fan. We Twitter from time to time. We're not great Twitterers. We're better on Facebook. And I was also inspired by Dawn's presentation to launch a YouTube channel, so hopefully we'll have our YouTube channel up in the next couple of months so that we'll have specific videos with researchers to try again to get some of the good information that's really coming about autism and more of what we're learning about what actually does cause autism out for everyone to use. So thank you very much.